WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends. David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Stories about mental health and school-age kids are a constant now, both in the news and in our conversations with family and friends. Every parent I know is talking about this. The rates of anxiety, of depression, and self-harm are all up sharply, trends that began in the 2010s. The social psychologist Jonathan Haidt argues that the current generation, people born after 1995, have experienced what he calls a great rewiring. In other words, having smartphones and social media accounts from childhood has affected not just their emotional lives, but their neurology too. Haidt's new book is called The Anxious Generation, and it's clearly connected with countless readers. The book debuted at number one on the nonfiction bestseller list. So I was raised on the, you're sitting too close to the television, mm-hmm. Your eyes will burn out, your brain will turn to jelly from watching The Three Stooges or whatever we were watching. And it was an incredibly powerful instrument. There were books written like 10 arguments for the getting rid of television. Getting the title semi-right anyway. But there were such polemics. Mm-hmm. Polemics not unlike your own in a way. They were evidence-based, however controversial. They seemed to have at least a grain of truth. Mm-hmm. And
yep, very plausible.
We survived radio. We survived television. Why is this so different?
Right. So first, let me acknowledge, because this is the one, there are really only two arguments I get. One of them is this one. Isn't this just another moral panic? We've been through, Socrates said writing was going to do us in, and whatever the young people are doing is going to be terrible, and then it turns out not to be. But this time is incredibly different, because before there was just, kids are watching TV, and then, much later there is a crime wave, but it can't be tightly linked to TV. The evidence doesn't show that when kids watch TV, they go out and hurt people or kill, so there was a lot of research. This time, there's never been anything like it. So here's what happens. The internet comes in two waves. In the 90s, we get personal computers, 80s and 90s, personal computers, and then we get dial-up internet. Slow, but it allows you to connect to the world. It's amazing. So the technological environment in the 90s was miraculous. We loved it. The millennial generation grew up on it. Their mental health was fine. So a lot of the indicators of teen mental health are actually steady or improving in the late 90s and then all the way through the 2000s. In 2008, the App Store comes out. Before then, there were no apps. They were just the things that Apple gave you. And I think it's 2009, something around there, is where push notifications come out. So now you have this thing in your pocket in which thousands or millions, literally, of companies are trying to get your attention and trying to keep you on their app. 2010, Instagram comes out, which was the first social media app designed to be exclusively used on the smartphone. So the environment that we adults were in suddenly changes, where now the iPhone isn't just a tool, it actually is a tool of mass distraction. And then in 2012, 2013, boom, it just, the graphs go way, way up, mental health falls off a cliff. It's incredibly sudden. So you can give me whatever theory you want about trends in American society, but nobody can explain why it happened so suddenly in 2012 and 2013, not just here, but in Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, Northern Europe. So, you know, I'm waiting for someone to find a chemical that was released just in those areas, you know, and a chemical that especially affects girls and especially young girls. Like, if someone can find that, you got another story. But until then...
You put a name to this. You call it the period between 2010 and 2015. You call it the great rewiring of childhood. Mm-hmm. What's happening then, in a granular sense?
Sure. So what I mean by the great rewiring is... the day that you change your flip phone for a smartphone and you have a front-facing camera and you have Instagram and you have high-speed data, which you didn't have before, that's the day that this device can become your master, not for all kids, but for a lot of them.
How does it become your master?
Even if there was no social media, kids are just much more subject to, when the thinking gets hard, I start looking for entertainment. I mean, I do this myself. You know, when I'm trying to write something and it's hard, I say, what's the weather? Let me go look at the weather. What's my email? I'm looking for anything that's more interesting and easier than the thing I'm trying to do. But I have a fully formed prefrontal cortex, and I have trouble with it. Teenagers don't. They don't have a fully formed prefrontal cortex. It's still in the child form. It's not very good at impulse control. And so as long as you have all these, you know, toys and games and interesting things happening on your phone, it's going to call you away. And that's without social media. Now let's add in social media.
And when does that come on online in a way that has a market effect in your view?
So social media before 2009 was just about connecting, and it was about performance, and it might make some kids anxious, but it was not particularly toxic. After 2009, now it's much more about not who you know, it's more about the things that people are putting out that went viral, that got a lot of likes. So once we get super viral social media in 2009, 2010, now a lot of things change. Now it's not just, hey, I'm bored, let me play a video game. It's my phone is pinging me saying, someone cited you in a photo, someone linked you in a photograph, or, you know, come check it out. Someone said something about you. Somebody just joined. Somebody liked your post. So we've allowed companies to reach our children, to manipulate them, to send their notifications whenever they want, and the kids don't seem to turn off the notifications. They seem to leave them on.
What you're describing, if I'm understanding your book correctly, and I spent a lot of time with it, is a change in human consciousness.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what does that mean?
So there's a long history of interesting scholarship on how tools change our consciousness. And, you know, I read some, Marshall McLuhan or Neil Postman, but, you know, when you get a change in technology, whether it's a change in what we do or how we communicate or how we can affect the world, it changes our consciousness. It's almost as though we were growing a third arm. I think McLuhan talks that way. It's the move to smartphones. This thing now moves to the center of your life. And so just the sheer number of hours that you spend looking at it.
And can we quantify the sheer number of hours? Mm-hmm.
Yes. So Common Sense Media and also Gallup and Pew, those three have given us really great data over the years. And the estimates vary. The most recent ones are 7 to 9 hours a day of entertainment screen time. So that's the phone, it's video games, it's iPads, it's all the internet connected stuff, not including school or work.
But when I think back on my own adolescence, there was a lot of, you know, watching television and kind of wasting time. Was that so much more socializing or psychologically healthy than spending more time with a smartphone?
Mm-hmm. Were you alone, or did you have siblings or friends?
Both.
So that's much better. So watching television, right? You're right.
Both alone and both with siblings.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But my point is that watching television, while our parents complained about it, when you look back on it, it was, my recollection was usually social. You're with another person. You're talking about the show. So you're together. It is social. Now what happens? You know, I've heard stories from Gen Z. You know, they go over to their, sometimes they do go over to their friend's house, not that much, but they do go over to their friend's house. And what happens?
And they're on their phones together.
Separate. No, right. One might be watching her shows on Netflix. One might be checking her. So even when they're physically together, Gen Z, there's a wonderful phrase from Sherry Turkle, because of our phones, we are forever elsewhere. We're never fully present.
The problem is, and I don't think you disagree with me on this, that there are aspects to social media, just as there are to the internet and writ large, that can be terrific, whether it's about finding community or staying connected to friends. How does society, technology, legislation, or parents possibly separate out that which you describe as legitimately harmful from what is potentially beneficial or fun or harmless?
Sure. First, let me be very clear. The internet is not the same thing as social media. So we're not talking about giving up the internet. I'm not talking about keeping kids off the internet. I'm talking about them not allowing them to sign a legal contract. It's not enforceable because they're minors, but it is a contract, the terms of service, to give away their data and some rights to a company that does not have their interests at heart. Yeah. That is using them as the product to sell to their customers who are the advertisers.
Okay,
that's what I don't want done to 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old kids. I think they should be 16 before they can be exploited in that way.
Now, you write, and this is a crucial part of your book, you write about sharp rises in rates of anxiety, depression, and self-harm that began showing themselves in a very concerning way in the 2010s.
Yep.
And you say that girls were hit hardest. Why does it affect girls differently than boys?
So if there's several reasons. The first is that when kids got smartphones and then tablets come in very soon and all these devices, they made different choices. Boys gravitate towards coalitional violence, which, you know, sports, team things. So video games.
Coalitional violence
that's
is
the
a
social
term for sports?
Well, it's
You're clearly not a sports fan.
It's true. I'm not.
Yeah, I can tell.
It's a social science term for how we just love, you know, making teams to do combat. And so football, you know, sports, you can't understand team sports unless you understand that we evolved for war and we enjoy it. We enjoy fake war. So the boys gravitate to video games and especially multiplayer video games, which are amazing. You know, I didn't let my son on Fortnite in sixth grade, and he does resent me for that. But I finally let him on in eighth grade. Thank God we did just before COVID because it was helpful during COVID. So for the boys, they go for that mostly. They also spend a lot of time on YouTube. They're on social media. YouTube is technically social media, but it's used more as a video library. So the boys, you know, they'll have Instagram accounts and things like that, but they're not as into it as the girls are. So the girls spend a lot more time on social media. They spend more time. They went especially for Instagram, Tumblr, Pinterest, for the visual platforms, and their interactions are asynchronous. So the boys are laughing it up at the same time, which is better than—
Together.
Even if they're separate. Even if they're in separate rooms, at least they're communicating. Whereas the girls are making a post. They're, you know, they spend an hour crafting the post and the picture. And then they're waiting for other kids to comment on it, including strangers, including adult men. They're waiting for strangers and friends to comment on it. And that's kind of anxious. And it's not play. It's performance. It's brand management.
Now, I also read your earlier book, The Coddling of the American Mind, and in it, you critique emotional safety, you know, the notion that we worship or valorize safety above all else. How does that jibe with your understandable desire to safeguard our emotional safety in this book?
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes you want a high level of safety. Sometimes you want a low level of safety. If the dangers aren't really, if there aren't much in the way of dangers, we don't want to force kids to wear a bike helmet when they're playing in a field. So it depends on the context. And my argument in the book is that we have vastly overprotected our children in the real world. We have to give them more freedom. And we have vastly underprotected them in the virtual world where there are no safeguards, no age limits, no protections. We can't even sue the companies that are harming them. And a lot of kids are getting severely damaged in many, many different ways. So am I contradicting myself? Well, then I contradict myself. No, we're overprotecting in one place and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
I'm speaking with social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. will continue in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 2018, Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff published a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. The book looks at cancel culture, arguing that schools have prioritized psychological comfort much too highly, that they've discouraged students from dealing with ideas that they don't agree with. I've been speaking today with Jonathan Haidt about his new book, which for some is no less controversial and every bit as timely. It's about anxiety. Haidt says that social media and smartphones have helped to create what he calls an anxious generation, which is the title of the book. One question that some critics have raised is about causation versus correlation. Haidt's book shows that being on your phone all the time may correlate with anxiety. But does that prove that one causes the other? We'll continue our conversation now. There was a review in the science journal, as I'm sure you're aware, Nature.
Yeah.
And it's gotten a lot of attention for saying that your assertions that digital technologies are somehow rewiring our kids' brains and causing an epidemic of mental illness is not quite supported by the science.
She didn't say not quite supported.
She said,
I have no evidence.
Well, I'm such a polite guy. Okay. Candace Ogers, I believe you're referring to, Candace Ogers, writing in this essay, says, quote, "The Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, the largest long-term study of adolescent brain development in the U.S., has found no evidence of drastic changes associated
with
digital technology use. So, How do you answer her?
So her main charge was that I have no evidence. She said, I don't know the difference between correlation and causation, and that she could use my writing in her intro stats class. And that's just not true. When it was mostly correlational, when it was almost all correlational, that was a fair criticism. But over time, there have been now dozens of experiments. So there are a variety of sources of data, different kinds of experiments.
So she just missed that.
Well, but note her wording. She when she said, I have no evidence, I think that was just an incorrect statement because I do have evidence. She is free to say, I disagree with it. I think these studies have problems. So that would have been fine if she said, he presents experiments, but I think that they're wrong. Fine. That would have been that would have been a reasonable thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just, I thought it was
She
just,
was too categorical in your in
Yeah,
your
to say that I have no evidence, I thought was not really correct. So that's what I said in my response.
So if it's not social media causing these issues mm-hmm. that you describe at length in kids, what else could it be?
Well, that's a good question. And that's the second problem with that review in Nature. I keep asking for alternative theories. I keep saying, okay, you don't think it's the smartphones and social media? What is it?
Well, the world is terrible. That's an alternate theory.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, hang on. Kids have a greater sense of ecological imperilment. The politics of the world are pretty awful.
Mm-hmm.
We're facing an election in November, just mm-hmm. as we did in 2016.
Oh, sure.
That has blah, blah, blah.
Things are terrible.
Yeah.
I agree with
yeah.
you. Things are terrible
yeah.
today.
Yeah.
Go back to Obama's first term.
Mm-hmm.
How terrible were things mm-hmm. in Obama's first term, 2008 to 2012? We're recovering from, or 2009 to whatever, we're recovering from the global, we have the global financial crisis, we're recovering. The economy is getting better and better in his second term. That's when mental health collapses. That's when kids suddenly decide, oh my God, things are mm-hmm. so terrible. And it's not high school kids who are reading the newspaper, perhaps, it's middle school girls are the ones who are most devastated by this. I don't think you could make a case that all of a sudden, in 2013, mm-hmm. 11 to 14-year-old girls suddenly freaked out about the political state of the world. And this happened not just here, but in Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand.
Or ecological or other conditions.
None of that makes sense. That's right. Another thing is, about the world being terrible hypothesis. When bad things happen, do people suddenly get depressed? No. You get depressed not because you think the world is bad. You get depressed because you feel isolated or alone. And so you and I grew up, I don't know how you felt about this, but I thought there probably won't be a nuclear war this year, but what are the odds we're going to go 20 years? It seemed to me like there's a good chance there's going to be a nuclear war. And the overpopulation is going to kill us. I mean, there were a lot of things wrong with the world in the 70s, but our generation didn't get depressed by it.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation the critique of you and your work as somebody who's worried about moral panic or inciting them. How would you describe the critique and how would you answer it?
The critique is what we started off with, which is this is no different from comic books and television. And I think, in Thomas Jefferson's time, in the 18th century, it was novels that were supposed to excite the sexual passion. I'm glad that I live in a world in which there are skeptics who keep alarm ringers honest. Otherwise, everything would be a moral panic. And I understand their frustration, the skeptics, that a lot of moral panics, we see them all the time. They end up being nothing. And it is up to me to say, actually, this time is different and here's why. And that's what I tried to do in The Anxious Generation, to say this time really is different. And in 2017, it wasn't so clear. But now what I'm finding is now that COVID is behind us and our confusion is lifting, our kids are messed up and it wasn't from COVID. It was actually in place before COVID. Everybody sees it. Most journalists who interview me, they'll say at some point in the interview, I read your book and, this is happening to my daughter. She's like right out of your book.
Am I wrong, Jonathan, to discern... And I haven't, but possibly discern a politics emanating from your work. In other words, your book on the coddling of the American mind could be put in a line with other books with similar temperament and an argument, like Alan Bloom, for example. Maybe you think I'm being unfair. And this book, I've heard, not me, but sort of people around the office who've, mm-hmm. who've read it, it's alarmist and it's just an old guy panicking about the latest cool thing. And it's, an impression begins to form that Jonathan Haidt is a social conservative in some mm-hmm. matter. Is that fair or is it wrong?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, so I'm glad to hear that. I was going to ask you, how am I perceived around here? And I could guess. So we live in an age of polarization with negative politics, where you're judged
by— Which you've also written about, too.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Where you're judged by who you criticize.
Right.
And so I've always thought of myself as a liberal. I'm also a kind of like a David Brooks sort of meliorist, like, you know, let's do the social science. Let's think about systems. Mm-hmm. Let's think in a really subtle way, not just this narrow, quantified way, but let's bring in cultural trends and let's see, can we make things a little better? And so when I saw universities kind of going off the deep end in 2015, Greg Lukianoff and I both mm-hmm. were very alarmed. Now, does that make me a conservative?
You were seeing it in your own students?
I was seeing it in students at NYU mm-hmm. and, you know, and hearing it from other professors. And the stories coming in from all over, it wasn't like that in 2013. I mean, it's just something changed around 2015. So anyway, my point, to get back to your question, I love universities. I love being a professor. I feel as though I am a member of an honored guild that stretches back to Socrates and Plato, and I see my institution getting corrupt. In the social sciences, it's not that people are doing things for money, but what I saw as corruption, I started talking about in 2011, mm-hmm. was in my field, everyone is on the left. All social psychologists are on the left. I gave a talk in 2011 where I went through many steps to find a conservative. I found one. I did find one. But everyone else is on the left. And I said, you know, this is going to be a problem for us.
Did you have an explanation for the why of that?
Yes. So part of it is normal self-selection based on personality. And so the arts are always going to lean left, just the nature of the psychological differences between those with a conservative and liberal temperament. So the arts, the social sciences, especially sociology, if you're questioning the social order, you're more yeah. likely. So there's a natural ratio. And in the 20th century, it was about 3-1 in psychology, 3-1 left, right. Let's say that's the natural ratio. I would never expect it to be 50-50. You don't need balance. What you need—
And that was a quantifiable thing?
Yeah. There were a number of surveys of who professors voted for. There mm-hmm. were self-report surveys of whether you're liberal or conservative. And they all converge on about the same thing. But my concern was we don't need balance. We don't need evenness. But there has to be someone in the room who's willing to speak up and say, that doesn't make sense. And what I was seeing was any conclusion that was conducive to the progressive view, that would get waved into publication. Oh, yeah, we want that one to be true. But any conclusion that went against it would have to climb mountains, and the reviews would be scathing, and
when
they'd be rejected.
When you say reviews, just to be clear, you mean scholarly reviews.
Yes, peer review.
Peer reviews allowing publication in university
yeah,
press
right.
books and
that's
publications.
Right, yeah. So just for example, so Steve Cici at Cornell and Wendy Williams, they had a line of work looking at gender bias in the sciences. To what extent do women in the sciences face a disadvantage in hiring and promotion? And what they found was that overall, it's a benefit. That overall, I can't remember which decades they were looking at, but I think it was in the 21st century, that overall, at least in recent years, there's not a bias against women, there's a bias for them. I think that's a perfectly plausible finding. It was incredibly difficult for them to publish that because what you need to show is that there is sexism and racism everywhere. That is the popular view. Now, my argument was, in 2011, was if we go down this road, if we continue to make fun of conservatives, which we do, you know, we tell jokes about them to our students. I mean, it was really a hostile climate for conservatives in the academy. If we continue to do this, we're going to hurt our own science, and we are going to lose any support from Republicans and red states. Mm-hmm. And so when I watched what happened last semester, where, you know, in the fall semester, and especially in that courtroom, in the Senate hearing room where those three presidents testified, you know, the country was disgusted with higher ed. And the survey data shows this. The trust in higher ed.
Just to be clear, you're referring to the congressional hearing about October 7th and the aftermath on college campuses, specifically Harvard, MIT.
That's right. Yes, correct. Right. And it was a House hearing. It was in the Senate, yeah.
And Representative Stefanik, who is herself not absent mm-hmm. Political ideology and motivation, was in the behind the microphone for the mm-hmm. crucial moment.
Yeah. Okay. But the point is there was a whole series of events. So I'd been writing about the decline mm-hmm. of trust in higher ed. Look, you asked me what my politics is.
Yeah.
I want my
you
mission.
Yeah.
So my mission is, and I even have, when I moved to NYU Stern, I wrote a mission statement. My mission is to use my research in moral psychology and that of others to help people understand each other across divisions and to help important institutions work well.
Jonathan, finally, what will happen to the anxious generation if nothing changes? Will they grow up feeling lonely and disconnected forever, or is this something they grow out of?
Yeah. So we don't know. What we can say is that young people in their 20s used to be the happiest people. There was what was called the U-shaped curve of happiness, where young people in their late teens and 20s are the happiest along with people in their 60s and 70s, and it's people in middle age who are less happy. That was true across the world until a few years ago. Now, a paper just came out by James Blanchflower, who's an expert on this topic. The U-shaped curve of happiness is over internationally. He looked at 27 countries, and he found that the late teens and early 20s, they're actually the least happy now or the most anxious, whatever the measure is. So there's been a huge change in young people. They used to be the happiest, and now they're the least happy. So are they going to grow out of this in their 20s? It doesn't look like it yet. There could well be lasting changes in their brains because we didn't protect them in puberty, and puberty is such an important time.
Essentially in the wiring of their brains.
Yeah, the brain is literally rewiring, literally in the sense of neurons are seeking each other out. Neurons are being, they're fading away if they're not used. Synapses are forming or fading away. So that happens very rapidly in the first couple of years of life. Then it slows down. But in puberty, it speeds up. So puberty is a time of really important rewiring. And traditional societies would give young people some guidance into how do you make the transition to adulthood. We don't do that. We give them an iPhone and an iPad, and we say, here, we're going to let you be guided into adulthood by a bunch of random people on the internet chosen by algorithm for their extremity, whatever it is. That's how you're going to rewire your brain. So it is possible that there are lasting effects and that Gen Z for the rest of their lives will be more anxious and fragile. That is possible. We just don't know. But the optimistic thing I can say is that there's a lot they can do to make themselves better quickly. I teach a course at Stern, at NYU Stern, called Flourishing. It's an undergraduate positive psychology course. And one of the most important things I do with the class is I say, we go through their notifications. How many do you get? 200 to 500 a day typically is how many the students get. And I say, turn off notifications for everything except for five. If you could only keep on five apps, like Uber, you surely want to keep on Uber and Lyft because you need to know, is the car coming or not? But, you know, do you need an update from the New York Times or from the New Yorker or anybody else about breaking? Okay. Oh, I tell them that. The New Yorker is different. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But, you know, but I mean, they get, you know, they don't, and most of them get a notification every time an email comes in. So if they get a piece of spam on email, they get interrupted in their daily life.
Yeah.
And so this has just become normal. They haven't learned to protect their attention. I try to convince them, and it's easy to convince, you know, your attention is the most precious thing you have. You could make huge amounts of money. There's no limit to how much money you could make, but there's a very severe limit on how much attention you have. You can't get more of it. So who are you going to give it away to? Tell me which companies you're going to allow to take your attention every day. And once you phrase it like that, they turn off almost all their notifications, and we get remarkable results. They say that they, for the first time, they can think clearly. They're able to do their homework. They're less anxious. So, you know, modern life is fragmenting all of us, and it's really doing a number on young people. If we reverse that, we improve their mental health.
But it seems that it requires the same discipline that it once did for someone to go off to a Zen Buddhist monastery to do what you're prescribing.
No, turning off notifications is easy. We do it in class.
Yeah.
Self-control is hard. But turning off notifications is easy.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
David, my pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist and a professor at the Stern School of Business of New York University. We'll be back in a moment with the legendary actor, Judi Dench. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for seven decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
You don't like me, Bond. You don't like my methods. You think I'm an accountant. A bean counter, more interested in my numbers than your instincts.
The thought had occurred to me.
Good. Because I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur. A relic of the Cold War.
So, wild guess here, a lot more of us have seen Judi Dench as M, the intelligence chief who's the boss of James Bond, than anything she's done in Shakespeare, particularly in the theater.
Hail King that shall be. Hail King that shall be. They met me in the day of success, and I've learned by the perfectest report, they have more in them than mortal knowledge.
But it's in Shakespeare's plays, in the theater, that Dench made her home and her reputation. She's played nearly all the big female roles, and she's distilled that body of knowledge and experience into a book called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. It's a collaboration with the actor Brendan O'Hay, and it delves into each role in each production that she's performed in. Dench has trouble with her vision, and she can't read a script anymore, but she has an enormous store of Shakespeare always at the ready. Could I ask you to recite a sonnet?
I can do one for you now, if
sure,
you like.
That would be fantastic.
When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contented least, yet in these thoughts myself almost despising, haply I think on thee. And then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered, such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings.
What a remarkable poem that is.
I think that's how it goes.
It's astonishing. Let's start from from the beginning. Do you have any memory of first hearing or seeing Shakespeare in your life?
Well, yes, in my home. My father used to be able to recite the whole of the Morte d'Arthur. And so recitation and singing and swimming and all those things were very much part of my childhood. And my brother, Geoffrey, only ever wanted to be an actor. And as a little boy, somebody would come to the house and eventually they would say, "Oh, and Geoff, what are you busy doing?" And he'd say, a school play or something like that. And suddenly he would launch into Julius Caesar as a really small boy. I can remember it now. For once upon a raw and gusty day, the troubled Tiber chafing with the shores, Caesar said to me, "Dares thou now, Cassius, leap in with me into this angry flood and swim to yonder point." And I could go on for a very, very
long
time.
And it's in you like that. It's internalized.
It was.
Like bones and blood.
It was. Going to school plays and seeing Shakespeare, which we all did at school, it was an organic part of the family. Very lucky for me.
I hate to ask you this question, but as you look at the way modern life has developed, and I'm holding up an iPhone on Zoom to show you Exhibit A, and all the media that has come in this wake, do you think that kind of life, that kind of childhood, and that kind of literary education is at all possible anymore?
I think it's possible, but maybe not probable.
The barriers are too high.
It's very sad, I think, for this kind of attitude toward Shakespeare is that it is a foreign language and something we don't understand. You know, he was, well, in my estimation, the greatest writer who understood about every single emotion that any of us might feel at any time. And it's not in a language you can't understand if it's done well.
Tell me about the first role that you ever had in a Shakespeare play.
I think it might have been as Titania at boarding school.
Mm. And do you remember anything about that performance, about that experience?
I do remember about it. I wore one of my mother's old evening dresses for the part.
I remember
that
great.
Very clearly. I'm not sure that she knew, actually, at the time. yes, I do remember that. That's a play I know unbelievably well. Mm. And never dreamt that I would play Titania at Stratford, or the first fairy at the Old Vic, or Hermia, or... never dreamt that I would. I was very lucky in that at school I was taught drama by somebody who had been an actress. I learnt that it wasn't a bookish kind of thing. There's nothing to be frightened of. That's what I learnt from her, that it is something that is accessible.
And it needs to be performed in front of you to get that sense more than just reading it from the text, don't you think?
I do think that.
Yeah.
I do think.
When did ambition kick in for you? At what point did your attitude toward acting, much less acting Shakespeare, cross over from something that one did in school and as a lark to something that you wanted to do as your life's work?
Well, I originally wanted to be a designer, and I was taken to Stratford by my parents in 1953 to see Michael Redgrave as Lear. And the set for that was so exquisite and so minimal. This was a set that was completely made the play continuous. I was training then to be a designer at York Art School. Mm-hmm. And I can remember thinking, I can't. That will never, ever be in my imagination to do a set like that. And then because Geoff, my brother, was already at Central and been an actor, I thought, I'll have a go at that. So I went and fortunately got into Central, which is a three-year training.
For American listeners, what is Central?
The Central School of Speech and Drama.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there for 3 years, and at the end of the 3 years, we did a public it wasn't a public show. It was a show in a West End theatre that we had chosen scenes from Shakespeare to do. And to that show was invited a representative of films, somebody I don't know, a representative from the Old Vic.
Hmm.
And there were about seven people there, that's all. And we all came on and did our things.
What was your thing?
And mine was a bit of Miranda in The Tempest.
Hmm.
And the next day, I got a message to go and see Michael Bentall at the Old Vic, 21 or 22.
And so suddenly the Old Vic comes calling, and destiny comes calling.
Yes, and not only that, but they cast me as Ophelia in Hamlet for the next season.
Who was Hamlet in that production?
John Neville.
Oh, my God.
And yes, oh, my God, as well, you might say, David, because all during our training, we used to go to the Vic to sit in the gods for ninepence and watch the seasons with John and Richard Burton, who were in them, before the Beatles, but nevertheless, that incredible thing of people going, wow, look at these two beautiful young men. You know, it was the same thing, only the Beatles kind of, you know.
Overwhelmed it.
Yes, but that's what I did.
Tell me a little bit about performing Ophelia at the Old Vic as a relative beginner.
Not good enough.
Not good enough.
That's what I have to tell you.
What do you
Not
mean?
Not good enough. Well, critics were very cross because, you know, the Vic at that time was the so-called National Theatre. We didn't have a National Theatre then. And they were very cross that Michael had cast somebody who is a newcomer.
You played, as I remember, in 1962, in a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, you played Titania.
Yes.
And then you played the same role 50 years later, in 2010. What was it like to...
For Peter Hall.
With Peter Hall. So what was it like to play that very same role, separated by half a century?
Well, I didn't have to learn it, because I remembered it. He set it up at the beginning like a group of actors coming into a building, and then he just wanted a character who was in a way representative of Elizabeth I coming in and looking down on them all and then coming down and as it were going to see the play, and then she suddenly sees this young man who is playing Oberon. She thinks, oh, hello, I think I might have a go at this myself, and gives Titania a nudge and said, I'll have a go at this. And that's how that evolved.
What is a rehearsal process that goes well and maybe sometimes it doesn't go so well?
Peter had this, I worked with him so many times, he would stand at a lectern with the script in front of him, so that you learnt about the iambic pentameter and the way the speech should be observed. But that sounds in a rather schoolmastery way. I don't mean that it was like that at all. But he would sometimes beat out the meter, you know. And
it sounds slightly terrifying to have him be a kind of metronome at
yes,
a lectern.
But I know.
And that tunes
I
your
know.
Ear.
The meter of it and the line endings was something you learnt about very early.
Can you give me an example? So some little bit of a play that where you're, how to do it well and how to do it poorly?
What you've got to get is the balance of the meter, which you must observe, the iambic pentameter, which is da-da, 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 da-da.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. Da 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 da. But at the same time, you can't. You must observe that, but the audience mustn't be aware that what's uppermost in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do a little bit of Titania.
Mm-hmm.
She says to Oberon, "These are the forgerers of jealousy, and never since the middle summer's spring met we on hill and dale, forest or mead, by paved fountain or by rushy brook, or on the beached margin of the sea, to dance our ringlets to the whistling wind. But with thy brawls thou hast disturbed our sport." Now you can, you see, you can elide lines together, but in a way you've got to learn a way of sounding as if that is one statement, which it is, but nevertheless marking the ends of the lines.
Is everything else easy, relatively speaking? Is Shakespeare in Love or James Bond or other things that you
James,
do?
There's nothing easy about James Bond.
Really? Tell me.
Acting a very tall girl in an office. Trying to know about things. Oh, gosh. I find all of it difficult. All of it difficult and all of it a challenge. The thing is that Shakespeare is in verse. You don't have to think about that, though. It's fatal to let an audience go away from a play only being aware of the fact that that was in some kind of verse. But it is equally bad that they go away from the play not hearing that beat of the heart.
Mm.
Because, you know, some of those lines there, when Viola is asked by Orsino, and he thinks she's a boy, you know, she's masquerading as a boy. She says, "My father had a daughter, loved a man. As it might be, were I a woman, I should, your lordship." And he said, now that is in verse.
Mm.
And he said, "Why, what's her history?" And she says, "A blank, my lord. She never told her love. But let concealment, like a worm i' the bud, feed on her damask cheek. She pined in thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief. Was not this love indeed?" We men may say more, swear more, but indeed our thoughts are more than will. Still we prove much in our vows, but little in our love. Does that go any way to explaining,
David? It does.
What I meant?
What it doesn't explain is why then you're saying that doing James Bond or Shakespeare in Love or seemingly more modern vernacular roles, why that is so hard too, or is equally hard even? Are you suggesting that it's equally hard to do that?
Why I love Shakespeare so much is because I feel very, very, very supported by it, by the text. You know, with M.
In Bond, yeah.
In Bond. Well, I knew Bernard Lee very well, who was the original M.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew him very, very well. He's the person I first did my first television with. So in my mind, it's always Bernard Lee. So that's quite difficult. But, you know, it's all difficult. I think it's all difficult. And sometimes you never crack it at all, I think.
What did you never crack? Of all your Shakespearean roles, if you look back, do you look back on any of them as in a spirit of regret, or I didn't quite achieve what I had hoped there?
That's why I've done a lot of them more than twice,
right.
And you get another go at something.
Have you ever forgotten your lines on stage? Or,
David, have you ever forgotten? Oh yes, and more times than I.
And
could
what's your
count.
Strategy? What do you do when that happens?
I knew with Shakespeare, you just put in the beats. Sir Ralph Richardson used to do it. When he played Prospero. And he had yells of hills, brooks, standing lakes and groves. And ye who on the sand with printless foot And if he dried on one of those words, he'd say, "Ye elves of hills, brooks, standing lakes and groves, and ye who on the sand with foot would chase the ebbing net." And, you know, the moments pass, and you all think, did he go? No, not Sir Ralph.
I like that. I like that. How is it different to do Shakespeare on stage and on film?
Much easier on stage, because the audience is so much part of it. The audience are there and you know if you're telling the story properly.
So it's not a matter of endurance, it's a matter of the audience presence is
that's entirely it's to do with.
Incredible. I never would have guessed that in a million years.
Well, otherwise I'm not going to get dressed up and go out on the stage and nobody do it for myself, am I?
Well, you and the camera is not.
I'm only going to do it for you, David. If I know you bought a seat,
right.
You know, I said that. Oh, my friend David's here, and then you say I'll do it for him. And I once was feeling very kind of off color, and I said to Ian McKellen, "I'm going to pretend that Jesus Christ, the Holy Ghost, and God the Father have bought three seats in the stalls, and I'm going to do it for them tonight." And he said, "Jude," he said, "that's absolutely terrific. They'll only need one seat," he said. It's the most adorable.
Judy Dench, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Very much indeed.
It was a great pleasure. Dame Judy Dench. She has a new book out called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent, written with Brendan O'Hay. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. Thank you for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell and Jared Paul. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, Jared Paul, and Alicia Zuckerman, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Alejandra Deckett.
And additional help this week from Hamza Salmi.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.